Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic.
Welcome to the West Building Lecture Hall of the National Gallery. I'm Eric Danker, the senior lecturer with the Education Division, and I'm pleased to be able to do this armchair tour of the Degas at the Opera exhibition that is currently here from March 1st until July 5th. Degas was one of the great innovators, one of the great avant-garde artists of his era. We normally associate him with the Impressionists. However, he always denied that there was anything spontaneous, anything that was quite so immediate about his work. Everything was very carefully planned. From the beginning, he was a great draftsman, following in the footsteps of his idol, Jean-Dominique Ingres. And Ingres had said to him to draw lines, draw more and more lines. And so we know that he began to sketch early on. Born in 1834, he goes to the Lycée with a friend, Ludovic Alivi, who will come into play here in a few moments. His family is very encouraging to him as an artist. They are affluent. They are in banking. Part of the family lives in Naples. Part of the family lives in Paris. We know that even when he does this very serious early self-portrait, which is not included in the exhibition, he's not holding a paintbrush, he's holding a drafting tool. He's holding something to do drawings. And so he defines himself early on in that way as somebody who will study and depict figures from various different angles, clothed and unclothed, various different poses. We know that early on he will do drawings that repeat certain figures where he plays with exactly how he wants them to be posed. He's often looking for characteristic, if sometimes awkward, poses. And he keeps a notebook of these drawings throughout his life, which he can employ as vocabulary to place into the context of particular scenes. We know that at the beginning, he thought of himself as a history painter, and he had the ambition to be a history painter. He did a number of different large-scale scenes, culminating in this work, done between 1860 and 1862, The Young Spartan Girls Challenging Boys. This is a scene that was based on a passage from Plutarch from his Life of Lycurgus. And the story goes that young Spartan girls were trained differently than any of the girls in other of the Greek cities, that as opposed to learning feminine arts, they were taught to fight, they were taught to compete, they were taught in sports, and that in fact they were taught to compete, throw javelins for instance, with their male counterparts. And so this presents an opportunity for him to show these young Spartan girls as they challenge the boys. And if you look very closely in the center of the scene, you will see Lycurgus in discussion with a number of the Spartan citizens. You can see that they're in a variety of different poses, and he's trying to capture, in this particular case, a sense of movement. One of the girls striding forward, some of the boys either drawing back or down on the ground or raising their arms. So this will inform his work throughout his interest in music. His interest in music starts early on because his father, Auguste Degas, was a very, very cultured man. He had salons on Monday afternoons, late Monday afternoons, early evenings, musical salons every Monday. And we know that Degas would have been in his father's circle listening to that music, absorbing some of that affection. We can see that in this painting, which is of Lorenzo Pagans, that's the guitarist that you see here, with his father, Auguste Degas, sitting there in the background by the piano. It is the only portrait he ever did of his father. He was very fond of his father, who was, again, very encouraging. You'll notice that his father not only sits before the piano, but that the piano music has been arranged to be a kind of halo for him, behind him. He's been really very thoughtful. Pagans was famous as a Spanish singer who'd come to Paris. He was from the Spanish town of Gerona, and he often did songs from his native country. So we're talking about Spain, and this is an important consideration because there is an influx of Spanish culture into France in the 1860s. And the reason for this has to do with the emperor, Napoleon III, having married the Spanish empress, Eugenie. And Eugenie brought culture with her. If you're familiar, for instance, with the Dead Toreador, it's part of that inspiration, Velázquez, Goya, and others. If you go to the Phillips collection, you'll see Manet's Spanish dance troupe. This is part of this same movement, and it culminates in 1870 with Bizet's opera of Carmen, and this will be associated with Degas as well. So he's sitting, playing the guitar in the ambiance of the parlor, of the living space of the Degas family. Degas was, in fact, introduced to opera by his good friend from the Lycée, and that was Ludovic Halévy. And Ludovic Halévy was a man of many talents. He was a writer. He was did musical composition. He wrote the libretto for Bizet's Carmen, and he was an avid opera and ballet aficionado. He is seen here with Albert Boulanger Cave, and he was also a professional involved with the theater, with the ballet, with the opera. And they are seen in front of one of the flats. They are backstage, but in front of one of the flats. And this is actually called The Two Friends. Again, it was Halévy who influenced him in terms of his affection for the opera. We usually note this as the first of the opera paintings, and I should reinforce the idea that operas were characterized by large dance scenes as well. So there was ballet in the opera. It was one of the things that attracted the audience at the time. This is a painting from 1867-68. It comes from the Brooklyn Museum, and it's a portrait of Eugénie Fiocque, apropos of the ballet La Source, The Source. The Source had debuted only in 1866. It was a great hit. It's a story that involves the future bride of the Khan riding through the Caucasus Mountains, coming upon spirits. Her name is Narida. She comes upon various different figures, including Jamel, who will help to rescue a sacred flower for her. The opera itself was particularly noteworthy because it had an actual brook on stage. There was running water on stage that came out of one of the sets, and it had an actual horse on stage as well. And we know that it was in the summer of 1867 that Degas approaches Mademoiselle Fiocque and requests to do this image. As you see it here, it's sometimes been thought that it was simply a pause in the action. In fact, it's clearly a rehearsal, and it's a pause in the rehearsal. The scene is dealt with as if it's a narrative scene, as if it's an ambitious history painting, with the princess sitting there meditating, resting her cheek on her hand in a gesture that goes back all the way to the Renaissance, denoting the idea of thoughtfulness. And she's surrounded. There are two other women here. There is the horse. For the horse, Degas had made a sculpture that he worked from, a sculpture in wax. He never actually brought the horse to the studio. It is a marvelous composition. We see the figures, we see the reflections in the brook, the water as it runs by. The only slight detail that suggests that it is a scene of the ballet are the ballet shoes that you can actually see through the horse's legs. And so I thought it would be useful both to have a better look at her and to see the ballet slippers as well. Along these lines, Degas then becomes interested as well in the activities of the opera goer as well as the opera itself. This is a scene from Robert le Diable, Robert the Devil, an opera that was by Giacomo Meyerbeer, which had first been performed in November of 1831. It was a regular opera in the sense that it was performed again and again over the following 60 years. In fact, we know that in Paris, there were 758 performances over the next 60 years. So there was nothing avant-garde about it. So what was it that attracted Degas, who was a regular attendee? In fact, it is a scene, a nocturnal scene, which shows reprobate dead nuns having arisen from the grave and dancing in this wild, chaotic way. On the one hand, it was a very suggestive scene. On the other hand, the dancers were well draped. And so this was a very popular aspect to the opera. As you look at it, Degas is just as interested in the audience as he is in the opera going on stage. So where are we? In fact, we're in perhaps the second row, and this is the orchestra level. It was reserved for men. Women sat upstairs in the boxes. And so we are season ticket holders who are there to admire the skills and the physiques of these young dancers. But the fact is that the opera had been performed sufficiently often that as you look at the figures that are down here in the audience, you can see that they're looking around, that the figure on the extreme left looks to see who's up in the boxes, who he might meet during intermission, that they're less interested in what's going on stage than they are what's going on around them. You will see the figure that is adjacent to the man with the opera glasses is a recognizable figure. He is the musician and composer Désiré Dio, and he will come up again shortly in our discussion. Degas had carefully studied the scene. Here is a contemporary image of what the stage set, very dramatic stage set, looked like. And of course, this being done in around 1870, 71, it is done in the old opera house, which was a far more intimate house, the Salle Le Pelletier, on the Rue Le Pelletier. And we are fortunate here at the National Gallery to have this image by Manet of the masked ball at the opera that shows you the intimacy of the foyers. And this is something that Degas not only enjoyed, but was very, very disappointed in when the new opera house would open in 1875, the famous Garnier Opera, which had been under construction for a dozen years by the time it was open. In this sense, what we see here is a scene of intimacy. In fact, it is a scene of sexual commerce. These are courtesans, upper-class prostitutes who have come to the opera in order to find and engage clients for the evening. Each of the six women has a mask on. One has dropped her domino. They are each in turn flirting with, approaching a man all the way on the extreme right, a man seated on a partition. Actually, you can see the leather bottoms to his shoes, and that courtesan leans right into his lap, covering up with the fan. The two figures that are cut off from the upper foyer are also courtesans. They are trying to attract the attention from down below, and they function as a kind of signpost for the kind of sexual commerce that's going on. The figure on the extreme left side of the image. The clown figure is actually a lampoon of the head of France at the time when this was done in 1873, Marshal MacMahon, who suggested that the loss in the Franco-Prussian War and the following commune were due to a lax morality that had been so important during the Second Empire. As you'll notice in the painting, nobody is paying attention to him, as nobody paid attention to him at the time, and this continued to be legal, if considered immoral, for the following half century. The figure all the way on the extreme right, just to the left of the man seated on the partition, with the brown beard, is Manet himself. He looks out at us. He is recording what's going on as a good realist so that he neither condemns nor condones this behavior. He simply records this as something that's going on. On the extreme left, next to the clown figure, the figure just on the other side of that courtesan with the beard, is the composer Emmanuel Chabrier. The taller figure engaged with them is Theodore Duret, who was one of the great writers and the first writer on the Impressionists. And so a variety of Manet's friends posed for this, and it is this amalgam put together as representative of theater goers and opera goers at that time. The Manet was submitted to the Salon in 1873. It was rejected, and probably for political reasons, although the Salon jury didn't have to say exactly why something was rejected. To go back to Degas, we know that he was commissioned to do a portrait of Désiré Dieu, who is in the orchestra. This is the sketch that we have managed to bring here for you. He's playing the bassoon. This is what the final painting looks like now in the Musée d'Orsay. It is a portrait, but it is a portrait of somebody in their field, at work. And Degas and Manet were exploring this theme at this moment, that it wasn't enough to be a likeness, but that they were involved in the kind of activity that defined them. And so here, Désiré Dieu, front and center, playing the bassoon. He is next to other recognizable figures. Behind him is his friend, Louis-Marie Pilet, who's a cellist, and we'll see him in a moment. You'll notice that Degas has had no qualms at all in mixing up the strings and the wind instruments to his own benefit. You'll also notice that on stage there are dancers. This is why people come to the opera. You'll notice in this case we are an abonné. We have the season tickets. We are in the very front row, just on the other side of that velvet partition from the orchestra. Up on stage, there are the dancers. There is Chabrier from the orchestra box. You can see him all the way up to the left in that box that's actually up on stage. It is perhaps no accident that the heads of the dancers are cut off, because the people who attend the opera are not interested in their minds and their heads, but interested in their bodies. And it is no accident that the neck of the cello extends up across onto the stage in a very graphic and suggestive way. And there is Degas' portrait of Pilet, the cellist, who we saw sitting behind, as you can see him here, all the way over to the left. Well, after these two paintings, Degas goes beyond the audience. We're still looking from an audience point of view, and he begins to explore other aspects of the opera and of the ballet. And so we have this famous scene of the dance class that is a painting that shows the dance master, the ballet master, Jules Perrault. He is directing a young woman in rehearsal. There are other ballerinas who are waiting on either side in the distance in the bleachers. We can see some mothers along with their children. It's, I think, important to note that most of the ballerinas came from the very lowest economic classes, and mostly their mothers and their parents pushed them into dance because it was the opportunity to escape from poverty and from that class by finding a wealthy patron, by being a successful dancer and singer. It's also worthwhile noting that Degas never did any of these scenes actually painting in the rehearsal rooms, that these are constructions in his own mind, and that while he may have seen the rehearsal rooms, they change readily from one depiction to another. For instance, as you look at this image, do we know if that large opening is a doorway into another space or a mirror? It will serve as either in other compositions. Moreover, Jules Perrault, the ballet master, was a famous dancer and teacher who had not been associated with the opera in probably 15 years by the time this was done. But Degas knew him, did drawings of him, and inserted him into this image. Again, I want you to notice the somewhat awkward but characteristic poses that you can see of these figures. And as you look, you'll notice the figure seated on the piano, scratching her back, for instance. And that is based on a drawing that he squared for transfer and used a number of different times. And you can see that figure here. And here's a close-up. And what's interesting to us is that this is one of a number of variations of this theme, so that we have the one that we just saw, but we also have this image. And you will see that the ballet master is similar. The ballerina is in a different position. Again, the framing is different for whether that is a mirror or meant to be an opening into another space. He's taken the girl down from off of the piano. There is a dancer in the foreground leaning toward us. And I want you to notice her head and how that's different from these figures. And the foreground figure here faces away from us, and she's holding a fan. And it's hard to make out what the design on that fan might be until we look and see that, in fact, Degas is playing with us, that originally there was a figure facing us, leaning over, and he's left her head and ear on the fan as if it were the decoration. So bear in mind the dance master here, because Jules Perrault will show up again, and we continue with the idea of rehearsal, but remove to the rehearsal on stage. And that's to be seen in this monotype. As you look at the monotype, you can see that the figure has been reversed, and that's because this is a printing process. So in the printing itself, it is naturally reversed. This is a monotype. It's quite a large monotype, and it's one of the two monotypes that was done while Ludovic Napoleon Lepic was teaching Degas how to do a monotype. So the plate is a similar plate, copper plate, that was used for etching or for engraving. But instead of incising any marks into the plate, the artist would use a thick viscous ink to create a design on the plate, manipulating the ink as long as they like, and then finally taking an impression from it. There were two ways of working on the plate in terms of painting. You could work positively, you could draw on the plate, you could paint on the plate, or, as in this case, the plate was covered with ink, and Degas makes the image by wiping away the ink, allowing the paper to show through. He then worked it up slightly with a little bit of chalk. If you look very closely, you'll see Lepic and Degas' name in the upper left-hand corner of the image. Now, Degas understood that with a monotype, after you were done with the design, you put it on the bed of the press, you put a piece of paper which had been soaked and blotted so it was nice and malleable, you put the paper over the plate and you put it on the bed of the press, which goes in between two rollers, and the upper roller supplies sufficient pressure to pick up the ink. When it comes out the other side, it's peeled away, and you have a monotype, and you can only make one that has the full integrity of the image you've made. However, you can ratchet the pressure up and take a second, a cognate, or a ghost, and Degas usually did this, and often worked them up in pastel so that there would be one in color and one in black and white. Lepic was an amateur artist. He was a printmaker. He bragged that he could vary the inking on a plate up to 85 times, and we know that for his image of the view of the banks of the Lescaut River, he had basically etched and then created times of day, created different weather conditions, created fires, put trees in, and he varied the wiping in his aquaphor mobile, his changeable etching. But he also introduced Degas and others into the idea of monotype. We often see that the associated artists and patrons are the objects of portraits. And so this painting, which is in Russia, is the Place de la Concorde by Degas. We did not borrow it for the exhibition because it's not relevant to the show, but it is of Count Ludovic Napoleon Lepic with his daughters and a greyhound. And it's necessary to mention that he was a dog breeder, and most of the dogs that you see in the works from the 1870s come through Lepic. This unique work in Degas' career is in grisaille. It's in monochrome. And that's because it was probably done in preparation for an engraving to advertise his work that would be in an English journal. It shows dancers on stage in rehearsal. So now we've moved onto the stage for rehearsal, and you'll see a stage manager, a director over at the far end there, sitting down, and then dancers in various different poses, some resting, some in fact rehearsing. Again, this is one of several. This is from the Musée d'Orsay, but there are several variations on this theme, including two that are in the Met, and they help us understand a little more. If you look very closely at the man sitting on the stage, to his right, you'll see the shadow of a second man who's been painted out, a pentimento. You'll also notice more obviously that the dancers on the extreme left were once taller. See their feet? That come down beyond where their feet are now. And so we can account for some of these by looking at the two variants that are in the Metropolitan. Here, the pastel over pen and ink drawing, which was then mounted on canvas. And now you can clearly see that second figure seated, slouching, over there to the extreme right. And that, in Degas' mind, perhaps, there was a necessity for there to be somebody orchestrating the rehearsal, as you can see from this figure. And you will also notice, once again, the neck of that instrument protruding into our scene somewhat graphically. It is in this regard that Degas' observations are very acute, because the season ticket holder was permitted not only to meet the dancers backstage in the green room, in the rehearsal rooms, but also permitted on stage during rehearsals and even in some cases during performances. That figure was not always welcome, and they're often seen to be rather menacing, as you can see in these two works that are here in the exhibition. Wealthy gentlemen, in many cases, were preying on the poverty and the susceptibility of these young women. And you can see it in these two images. And you can see it here as well, where we're back behind the curtains, and you can see not only the gentleman in the foreground with a young ballerina racing away from him, but you'll see other men behind the flats. And then if you look very carefully, you'll see that there are even male trousers behind the scenery in the back. And this was one of the aspects that Degas, better really than anyone else, captured of some of the inequities, some of the more evil aspects of opera and ballet at the time. So we've been backstage, we've been at rehearsal, And now the star, a ballerina who is actually on stage taking a kind of star turn here in this Musée d'Orsay Pastel. But even here, with this odd point of view, and Degas specializes in very unusual angles of vision, even here, as we look down and we see her and we see other dancers behind the flats, there is a well-dressed male figure hiding behind the flat as well, even during this marvelous instance of the ballerina on stage. Rarely does he turn to the female attendees at the opera, once in a while, and so we have this pastel that we're pleased to have that shows the place where the previous pastel would have been done from up high at an angle looking down. And if we're interested, as Degas was, in what is going on stage, we should also be interested in the applause and the actual acknowledgement of the mastery of the dancers after the ballet, as this ballerina, illuminated by floor lights before her, holds a bouquet of flowers given to her for the excellence of her dance and by, no doubt, a male admirer. We're reminded when we see this that Degas was interested in ballet for yet another reason. I've talked to you about how much he was interested in drawing the same figure over and over, in perfecting posture, in returning to the same image again and again, in attempts to clarify, so that when he did a final product, it would seem somewhat effortless. And we can thereby make the comparison, because Degas thought of them, and the hard work that went into practicing and learning the roles in order to make the performance look effortless. And so there is this parallel in his work and with his subject matter. It is about this time, 1880, that he becomes interested in elongated designs, paintings that were both inspired by Renaissance predella panels and narrative scenes, but also by Japanese woodblock prints as well as Japanese scrolls. Again, he normally did drawings in advance, and here is a figure seated, leaning forward, dressed in red. Next to her, another figure seen in profile, done in black chalk. These were done for the upper painting here, which is in the National Gallery's collection. It appears to be the first one of those of the elongated formats. And you can see that he's used those two figures but moved them apart. Interestingly enough, in the upper of these two images, what you see is ballerina tired. She is actually sitting on a base. And then the wall leads us back at the orthogonal, takes us back at a very steep angle into the background, to the windows, and to dancers seen in the distance. He would repeat these formats, changing some of the colors, changing some of the windows, and certainly some of the ballerinas. And you can see this in the lower of the images, where he's actually created a staircase coming up into the rehearsal room, which was never there. He would be apt to invent. So there are two paintings that are in the exhibition with circular stairs that never existed in the rehearsal rooms either. You can see those variations by looking along, and you can see the changes in the color of the wall, how far it extends into the space, whether or not the ballerina is sitting on the base or posing next to the base while adjusting her sandal. These are variations on a theme, and Degas is exploring the most expressive solution to each of these formats. He would do the same thing in these two paintings, which show us two resting ballerinas over to the right side in front of the wall, and then either ballerinas who are at the bar to the far left in the lower of these two images from the National Gallery, or the one above where a series of windows leads us back to the one ballerina actually at the bar. in the same room with these elongated formats, we have put on display a series of fans that he did. And the fans were done at a time when the Degas banks had failed, when he, in fact, needed money. And we know that he went out of his way to think of various different ways of earning money, whether doing prints, publishing a print journal, in this case, doing these small-scale fans. And he does a series of them, and they're very interesting. They often have dancers on them. They use space in a very interesting way. Perhaps the most finished and fascinating of these is this image, which we have of Spanish dancers and musicians. This may be among the very earliest that he did. It is done around 1869, and it is very carefully done. It's more detailed than most of the others. It was a gift to his friend Bert Morisot. And Morisot then included it in the background of this painting of the two sisters, which we have here in the National Gallery's permanent collection. It is probably not two sisters. It is probably one woman who is posed in two separate postures. But for us, the importance is in the use of that fan in the background. Degas' eyesight was always weak. He always rejected the idea of painting out of doors, as so many of his Impressionist friends preferred to do. We know that as his sight weakened by the 1890s, he turned more and more to pastel on a large scale and painting. There is a new fluorescence in his color, the brilliant color, which he begins to use at this time, often with a much softer focus. You can see it here with this large-scale image of the four dancers in blue, perhaps the largest of these in the National Gallery's permanent collection, is this image called Four Dancers. They are on stage. They're in front of flats, which remind us a little bit of the work of Monet and the work of Gauguin, these grain stacks. Degas had a great interest in photography, and we no longer are certain that this is of four separate dancers. In fact, it seems as if it might be one dancer caught in four different poses. He also began at this time to use rather strong black contours, but his eyesight was not good, and we know that the contours often fall outside of the areas of color that he used. And this is due to that failing eyesight and softening of effects. In the final room of the exhibition, we show the one sculpture that he ever displayed in public during his lifetime. We are pleased that here at the National Gallery, we have the largest and most important collection of Degas waxes and of the associated bronzes. But the little 14-year-old dancer, which he showed in the 6th Impressionist exhibition in 1881, was the only one that he showed in public, and none of these were cast until after his lifetime. We have one of the casts. It's in the sculpture galleries that was done out of an edition of about 25. But we've put the original made of actual wax and of ballet slippers and of the tutu and of horsehair for her hair in the exhibition itself. And it's very fragile, but we're glad to be able to display it in this way. He had selected a 14-year-old dancer, Marie van Gettem, and posed her. He drew her from every conceivable angle. He drew her both clothed and lacking clothes. We know that he sculpted in wax as well. And finally, he displayed this image. It was excoriated by the critics at the time, who were used to sculpture that was idealized and classical, as opposed to the kind of naturalism that we see here in Degas' work. I will read you just one of the newspaper critiques, this one by Henri Trianon in Le Constitutionnel, came in April of 1881. If he wants to show us a statuette of a dancer, he chooses her from among the most odiously ugly. He makes it the standard of horror and bestiality. And yes, certainly among the dregs of the dance schools are poor girls who look like this young monster. However, she is sturdy and carefully studied. But what is the use of these things in the art of sculpture? Put them in a museum of zoology, anthropology, or physiology, fine, but in a museum of art, forget it. And this was characteristic of many of the reviews of the time who just simply didn't understand Degas' naturalist impulse. The critics won the day. He never showed sculpture again over the course of his life. She is one of those figures who were called rads. They were yet to develop as young ladies. There were four different stages leading up to those who were stars. We know that she was one of the lower stages. Unfortunately, we lose track of her after this is done. She stops attending school, and then we lose track of her entirely. Degas is the master of the dance. But the dance took place in the opera houses, both in the Salle Le Pelletier and in the new Garnier Opera House. Degas hated the new opera house. He said it was too ostentatious. It was too over the top. It lacked all of the intimacy of the older opera house. He didn't like the grand entrance. He didn't like the monumental stairways. He didn't like the new rehearsal rooms, which were done very elaborately to provide a better setting for those season ticket holders to meet with the young dancers. He rejected everything about the new opera house except for the performances themselves. And so we're very pleased to be able to present Degas in the various different guises of the opera goer, of the aficionado, of the rehearsal attendee. We're pleased that we're able to show the variations on a theme throughout his career and to show, not chronologically, but thematically, the way in which this had a major impact on his work. God died in 1917, acknowledged as one of the great masters of French painting in the second half of the 19th century. I hope you'll take the time, particularly today, to go to the exhibition, to look closely not only at the work that I've shown you, but to look at the sketches alongside and the other variations, and also to walk over to the other side, to the permanent collection sculpture galleries, where you'll see sculpture of dancers, of women bathing, of horses, and you'll recognize some of the poses that he used in the drawings, the pastels, and the paintings in Degas at the Opera. Thanks so much for coming today.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.